Okay, everybody, we're going to resume with our second session here. You'll notice that we get half of the lectures out of the way the first day. And then there's time for other activities with one lecture on Saturday and one on Sunday, questions and answers. Plenty of free time and the Chuck C DVD, which is... Those of you that never had the privilege of meeting him, he died in 1982. It just gives you a glimpse of his energy, which I just still feel to this day. While I'm on Chuck C, I'll tell you a Chuck C story. I think I got invited to talk the first time out of town in 1970. And I went over to some big deal in Baltimore, and somebody from Indiana or somewhere like that was there. And so they invited me out to Indiana. And Wino Joe was the big speaker. Here's another character in AA. He'd been around quite a while. And myself and a guy who was a pig farmer were the two junior speakers. And somewhere in my talk, I mentioned that it's very, you want something that's not very comfortable, is throwing up in an oxygen mask. And then the pig farmer had a lot of stories about pigs, et cetera. So now it's Wino Joe's turn as the feature speaker. And he got up there and he says, I'm Wino Joe from Tyler, Texas, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the first time I've been on a program with a pig farmer and a puking Marine. And that was my entire description of who I was, a puking Marine. But I got to see Wino Joe a few times, and what a character. So probably about 4 years later, I was in the Midwest again, and the Al-Anon speaker was Elsa Chamberlain, Chuck's wife, who was just beautiful and wonderful and amazing talk. And she heard me talk and thought it was great. So she went back to Chuck and said, you have to invite this guy to the Palm Springs Roundup, which is a big deal for the Californians. And Chuck said, well, I don't know him. I'm not going to invite him there. I mean, my reputation is on the line. Have you got one of his talks? He doesn't have any talks. Nobody taped him or anything. And Chuck said, well, I'm not going to invite some guy out here without having heard him. And Elsa said, well, you'll be sleeping alone. Now, I don't know anything like this. I just know Chuck Chamberlain is like somebody, woo. So my phone rings. Is this anybody? Yeah. Well, this is Chuck Chamberlain. And I was sure it was my friend Hal Marley pulling my leg. Yeah, sure, Chuck. Yeah. He said, no, this is Chuck Chamberlain. I went, oh, my God. And he said, my wife said I have to invite you to the Palm Springs Roundup. And I went out there, and that's where Drop the Rock was. And Chuck loved it. If I had bombed, I never would have got to go down to Chuck's house and hang out in Laguna Beach. But I was invited down there. He took a liking to me. So I got to experience them. So let's see, I have 12 years sobriety at the time. And I went there between 77 and 79. Maybe 5 or 6 times. So I'm in somewhere around 13, 14 years sobriety, and I'm sitting there, and Chuck is talking in his living room, and I'm just overwhelmed with the beauty and the spirituality of all of this. I just sat there just going, oh, my God, oh, my God. But when I left, I realized I had no idea what he was talking about. It wasn't until years later that I could fully understand what he was talking about because I started to experience it. And that's where the rubber meets the road. It's when you have the experience. And while I'm on that subject, before I get around to this, one of the best ways to describe God to a newcomer is to tell them that in Alcoholics Anonymous, until you have this experience that's described in the Spiritual Awakening, God is just a word. It has no depth, it has nothing until you have the experience. Matter of fact, it's a theory. You have this theory that if you ask God to help you, he will, but you don't know. And in this experience, something happens, and you say to yourself, oh, this is the God they're talking about. See, it's quite different from a religion, because we can't give you a definition. We can't give you a history. We can't tell you any background. We can only tell you how to have this experience. And then when you have the experience, you can attribute it to whatever word you want. But in the long run, I said higher power for 5 years. Didn't want to get caught saying God. And after 5 years, I said, you know, you could say God faster than higher power. And who cares anymore? You proved your point. And so I just said, yeah, okay, God's fine with me. But what do I mean when I say that? I mean the experience that I had as a result of these steps. So sometimes I think the step could say God as we experience him. Because understanding God is impossible. It's just way beyond, it's a mystery. And so mysteries, there's two things you can do with mysteries. You can try and figure them out, or you can enjoy them. And it's suggested that you simply sit in wonder at this incredible mystery. And I like magicians, because they do things and I go, oh, how the hell do you do that? It's almost beyond possibility that could happen. I just saw him go over here, now he's over here. Whoa. The worst thing in the world would be if they showed me how it's done. It wouldn't be much fun then. I'd just go, I know that. You go here, there's a little tunnel coming over here. Big deal. Anybody could do that. So the fun for me is not trying to find out how the trick works, but to just sit back and go, wow. And while I'm on that subject, I think that's one of God's favorite prayers. Wow. When you take a look at the world he created and the universe and take it all in and just go, wow. I think he gets a kick out of that. That you appreciated it and are in a position to reflect on things like that. So that's off on the sidetrack, but there seems to be more trouble with the word God in AA than there was 25 years ago. I don't know why. And so I think that if you're dealing with somebody new and you explain it to them, that they will have an experience and it's up to them how they explain that experience. But most of us say, so that's the God they're talking about. Up till then, it's just a three-letter word that rhymes with odd that other people seem to think is great. And we also differ in that we're not trying to impose my view of this higher power on you. I'm just trying to show you how you can have this experience, and then it's up to you to explain it to yourself and to anybody else. So anyway, getting back to Chuck and his basic premise that there's only one problem that includes all problems, and that is conscious separation, meaning in our consciousness, when we look around, we are a separate being from everybody in this room, from from everything. And because of that conscious perception, all the other problems, all the ills that human beings have come from that. And if that was eradicated with conscious contact, it would be impossible to have any problems. Isn't that amazing? It would be impossible. Now that's a pretty big deal, isn't it? It would be impossible to have any problems. It's kind of like when you experience peace of mind, there's nothing for alcohol to fix. So it's real easy to not drink. Because drinking was designed to fix the terrible problem of sobriety. Every time I'm sober, I'm very painful. When I look at the world, it's terrible. And when I have a drink, it changes what I see. And I want to get out of this world that I'm in. And so I found alcohol. So for most of us, it was a very close to a spiritual experience in that some power greater than ourselves was changing the world that we lived in. So that after three drinks, we looked around and went, now, this is more like it. I can still feel that in a bar. I come in there all uptight, all this, and then I would look around. It was the same motley crowd, same dirty, dingy bar, but I would just go, yeah, this is more like, this is great. How you doing? Great. No, doing great. And in that particular time frame, I just couldn't think of a problem. Now later on, after 12 drinks, I didn't like the way that guy was looking at me, and then we were into other troubles. But there was that magic moment around the third or fourth drink when it's about as good as it gets, but it was hard to stay there. So we have this, we talked the last time about how, as we look around, our character defects are based on stories and self-centeredness, and that's a story, and just that the whole construction of everything seems to be based on a story. Now we get into why it's even deeper problem than what we described the first hour. Now we're getting into, and the term that I came up with is describing, you want to describe a new guy you're sponsoring who really, you know, 4 DWIs, 10 arrests, beating the crap out of this, you know, just right down the list, we would say he has a very storied past. It was a polite way of saying, you're not going to believe this. So we suddenly find that not only is the present composed of stories, but so is the past. And it doesn't take much imagination to realize, so is the future. Since the only moment that is real is the present, and we don't know how to live there, because the stories have us all confused and we think we're self-centered, all that, then the only two places we could go are the past and the future. But there's no such thing. So we have to make up a story. And when people ask us about things, well, tell me about grammar school. Tell me about this. Tell me about that. And then we come up with our version of what happened. Do you follow what I'm saying? Our version. We think this is it. This is the gospel truth. I'm telling you what really happened. And I have lately had that great story about flying and at the end of the line, I couldn't fly anymore and I made a flight of 4 land. I just had to get out of the plane. It was just so awful. And we did land, and we got I got some drinks in me, and it felt a little better. And then the next morning, we went out to refuel and go back to Cherry Point, and I told the flight leader I wasn't going to fly anymore. And alcohol decided that was the end. Somebody else flew back, and then I spent 3 months waiting to get reassigned, and I did the legal work, and I had 3 months of shame. And the other pilots just looked in the window of the office, and I could just see them. They were just going, how did that piece of crap get in our squadron? We're a very elite photo squadron during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Crusader was a hell of a good airplane back then. What is this guy doing in with us? And I had 3 months of shame. And I could relive it any time I wanted. All I had to do was think back on when I lost, you know, flying took away from me, and then there I sat in that. It was just heavy, heavy-duty shame. And a couple of years ago at Brentwood, some guy came up and announced that he was in the plane with me when that happened. And he was. And I didn't remember him. So we had this long conversation. He brought photos of the squadron, and we did this and that. And then he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? It was killing us that you were leaving. The colonel tried everything to keep you there. It was the saddest day in our lives when you left. And I went, oh, that's not how I remember it. I don't remember. That's not my story about what happened back then. But the evidence was overwhelming that I was wrong. So I had to go back 42 years and change my past. Well, I didn't know you could change your past. You're not changing your past. You're changing your story about the past, which is the same as changing the past. Do you follow what I'm saying? Because that's the only thing you got, is the story about the past. So now when I think about 1962, Cherry Point, I go, man, what a group of guys. They were, you know, they're just trying to help me. Nobody knew about alcoholism. Nobody knew about AA. Wow, I was really lucky to be with those guys. Boy, if I'd been with some bad guys. So I can just go back and have very pleasant memories about a very horrible, formerly horrible thing. So you can see that our past and our ideas about it should be suspect. Perhaps your version about your past has some flaws in it. Possibly. Possibly. And I always use this line. I heard it from some speaker, but it fits in perfectly with talking about this. He gets up to the podium and, you know, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My story is divided into two parts, what happened during the years that I drank and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. And then everybody, yeah, that's funny, that's funny. What happened and what I thought happened. And it doesn't take a big stretch to realize you could do that with your childhood. You could do that with high school. You could do it with everything. My childhood's divided into two parts, what happened when I was a child and what I thought happened. What I thought happened. What my story about my childhood is, with all the adjectives that I put in. Rotten parents come from beating you up to spoiling you. If they hadn't spoiled me, I'd be much better adjusted. So I was abused by my parents. They gave me everything I wanted. I've heard alcoholics say that. So I learned no responsibility. I ended up, it's all my parents' fault. And on the other side of the thing, you know, my dad beat me up and whacked me and threw me on the ground and blah, blah, blah. So that's why. That's my story and why I'm screwed up. We never take responsibility for ourselves. But you can see that the whole past is built on a series of stories. The first girlfriend, the this, the that. And as we tell the story to ourselves, we emotionally react to it. You know, think back on the saddest day when your girlfriend says she's leaving you for Fred, the biggest jerk in high school. If you want, if you really are good, you can go back and almost suffer as much as you did when you were 16. If you're good at this, if you're a good storyteller, you can almost bring tears to your eyes at age 53 for something that happened when you were 16. Isn't that amazing? And most of it comes because we have no idea how to live in the now. And we got to hang out somewhere. Since we can't hang out in the present moment because we have no concept of it, there's only two choices, and one is the past and one is the future. Well, how could you live in the future? It's not even here yet. Well, I just make up a story about the future and scare the shit out of myself. We do it all the time. Wow, that thing in Greece is looking bad. I'll be on unemployment in about a month. They're going to collapse the world economy, and I'm going to be in bad shape. God! Ugh. And Bill used to call it, remember his imaginary ulcers would kick in? He had that story about he would lie around worrying about things and his imaginary ulcers. He was always talking about his imaginary ulcers. I think the future and stories about the future occupy everybody in this room a great deal of your time. Just if it's not worrying about the future, it's planning for it and setting a series of actions that are going to finally make you happy. I think we talked about the last time. They're going to finally make you happy. If you're working with a new person who comes over and says, I'm just not happy, I just feel terrible. What if you said to them, what if you're wrong? What if you really are happy? They go, well, how the hell could that be? Well, let's look at your life. Let's take a look at it. Let's see where you are. What do you got, 6 months sobriety? And they just ask, you're the coffee maker now? Half the people in the group are so glad that you just have joined us. And your parents like you now, right? They invited you over. They're happy to have you back. Your family was, well, and you keep on going. I remember my sponsor did that, and I went, well, if you look at it that way. If you stop looking at your story, you find out that you're happy. You already are. You don't have to wait to get happy. You already are. And very often when I'm working with people, they have a problem, and they come over to talk to me about it. My job is to convince them they don't have a problem. They made a mistake. And I joke around, and I said, we ought to have a panel in our home groups of three elders. And if you have a problem, you go up and sit in front of the three elders and tell them what your problem is, and they will consult among themselves and vote on whether it qualifies as a problem. Can you see a lot of problems just disappear? Oh, come on, you think that's a problem. I'm sorry, get out of here, that's not a problem. And you go, well, geez, I thought I had one, but I was outvoted unanimously that I don't have a problem. And the second you say, I don't have a problem, you feel better. You see the power of stories? It's just unreal. And we could go on and on with this whole thing that isn't real. That's the thing that starts to sink in as we move along in the spiritual program. it seems that there might be something lurking behind the story. It seems that, and we just had glimpses, we've just had little feelings inside, that there might be something, we don't know what it is, that is more real than this reality, the one that we made up, the one that's our story. And that's a huge turning point, to have any sort of an awareness that there is something beyond my story, something beyond my mind, something of an eternal nature. And there's Howard and I were talking about this. Science has advanced so far that many of the mysteries that we used to need God to explain are now explainable in pure scientific terms. So we don't need God to fill in these blanks. And therefore, the ego is jumping on the bandwagon that we are it, which is, it just makes it more difficult for alcoholics coming in here if they have that background, and there's a lot of them. I had a gal from Harvard, she had an MA from Harvard, and she was terrified that her classmates would find out she was talking about God, and she would be persona non grata. Gratis or whatever it is. And so I started looking at authors and leaders in this whole thing, and there are top scientists and a lot of college professors, and it's kind of the new religion, if you can call atheism a religion. But it's kind of a new thing. It's not a problem that I had when I came in. I didn't have any peers that were going to look down at me if I said the word God. So it's an extra problem. And the thing I'm leading up to is, amongst this crowd are some top scientists who are perfectly comfortable with science and God. Perfectly comfortable. So I decided to read them as well as the others. And one that I'm going to share about is, his name is Francis Collins. He headed the team that broke the genetic code. And he has a book, The Language of God. So I'm reading the book, and I'm seeing how he's paralleling, and this is how God did it. He chose to go this way, blah, 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 blah. And it's just going along. And then he mentions that he was an atheist for most of his life. But something changed his mind. It was C.S. Lewis, and that's a book that all of C.S. Lewis is just an amazing person. Now, oddly enough, Anthony Hopkins played him in the movie, and we've got Narnia, we got this, but the thing that changed him was Mere Christianity. And for the last 5 years, when I have people who have a hard time with God, I say, just read the first 31 pages of Mere Christianity. And in there, C.S. Lewis is just so a brilliant writer, speaker, whatever. And he was giving radio broadcasts to the British troops in World War II, helping them with their fears and trying to bring them into contact with God so they could have an extra way of surviving a war. And he did it not by talking about anything outside at all, but only by pointing out things about them in a way that they saw themselves entirely different. That's the ultimate, and Bill writes that in our big book, The Fundamental Idea of God is already inside of us. So if we had a skillful enough communicator who could talk about what's going on, we could come to the conclusion on our own with no external evidence. That's a pretty good job. And that's what this scientist did. Now, I'm no C.S. Lewis to try and duplicate the way he went about it, but he simply pointed out that inside of you, all by itself, is some kind of a moral law that you didn't put there, and it's inside of every person. And if you go around the world to various countries, it's remarkably the same. And it's an internal code of behavior that you can't live up to. You fail. You cannot live up to this. And the people that deny they have it, he says, what if someone else violates that code? Aren't you the first to say, hey, you shouldn't behave that way? You shouldn't have done that. Based on what? And it's based on this same pre-existing, they used to call it the law of nature, they call it the moral law, that you can't live up to. And the second thing is, you just have this uncanny sense that something wants you to try and live up to it. And that is there, and it's present. And so if you think about how some creator of the universe would want to make us aware of the spiritual nature, this is not a bad plan. It's just not a bad plan. No matter how hard we try, we can't get rid of that internal, invisible, uncaused laws, moral guidelines, whatever you want. I remember when I was drinking, I had no idea this is what my problem was. I was trying to drink and kill that part of me. I didn't know what to call it, but it was there. And then I could sin guilt-free. That was my goal. Can you imagine having that for a goal? If I could get rid of whatever the hell this thing is and eliminate it, I could do anything I want and have no repercussions later on, which is, you know, like trying to kill your soul. If I could just kill my soul, I could have peace of mind. Total insanity. But I can remember thinking that. And it just ties in so well when Bill writes, the fundamental idea of God is deep down inside of us. It's only there that he can be found. We've been looking in all the wrong places. We've been listening to stories that we made up. When William James was writing about, he did a lot of writing, but he did write about religion and the varieties of religious experience. And then he was commenting on what was taking place just as AA was being formed, which was the New Age, New Thought movement that was occurring in the Christianity and all around the country. Kind of one of the first ones I remember was Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking, Think Your Way to Peace of Mind, Think Your Way. You can get these thoughts. If you can control your thoughts, you can transform yourself, you can move on and all that. And it was very popular. Even Emmett Fox was into that. I mean, it was really a new version. And both him, and I'll tell you, Ernie Kurtz and his history of AA and William James said, that's not AA. AA doesn't see human beings that way, where you can, everything is beautiful. I just have these thoughts and just follow them and they'll take you and you can be free from any negative side of yourself. Kurtz says that we're neither saint nor sinner, but both. And we have to be comfortable playing those roles. It's as if our ego is somehow our enemy. And I, after quite a few years of bad-mouthing my ego, I got tired because that's part of me. You know what I mean? And I'm going, oh, yeah. And somewhere I read a wonderful way of thinking about the human ego. And it goes like this. If you're learning how to play basketball, and you got a basketball net out in your driveway, and you're making moves, and you've got shots you can't believe, and you spin around this and that, you're getting pretty good. I mean, you're out there. You just made 12 shots from 25 feet in a row. Swish. I mean, you really are going. But the only way of knowing if you're any good is to get somebody out there who's going to try and stop you from scoring any points at all. Competition. Your brother. Somebody who's trying to block you from getting the basket. Now you're going to get a lot better than you could get on your own. So in order to really make any progress, we need a spoiler. We need somebody who's trying to get in our way and get in our face, whether it's by telling us we're a piece of crap or not letting us sleep or whatever it is. And somewhere along the line, I was able to put my ego in that role and to come to the conclusion that he wants to go home just as much as I do. And we're both on the same team. He just has a hell of a thankless job. You follow what I'm saying? Trying to ruin every day I have. But it helped me to get more comfortable with being divided. And we can work as hard as we want to try and unite ourselves. And that's what that new thought thing, you can do this and you can do it on your own. And William James had, I think he called it, New Thought, New Age was therapeutic narcissism. And his comment on the philosophy of everything is wonderful was, all sunshine makes a desert. Whoa! So AA, we talk about defects. We talk about this side of us, and it's going to be there. I think Bill said it was nowhere recorded where anybody ever got rid of all their defects. So somehow we have to come and have absolute peace with the fact that this struggle is going on, and it's never going to stop. Now we can have peace of mind because we're not expecting this struggle to suddenly be all perfect. The way that we move towards a more comfortable is all through what we're going to talk about tomorrow, the steps to ensure conscious contact. So if I'm trying to work on these two forces, what I really work on is conscious contact. And then this starts taking care of itself. The struggle becomes less. But the solution is always there instead of going after. And that's why in the sixth and seventh steps, who's going to get rid of this stuff? God. And we'll talk about that, more about that tomorrow, which is why our divided self wants to fight even letting God do it and tells us you could do it yourself. You don't need to involve God. You can get honest. You can do that. You can do this. And I remember one time trying to disprove that you need God to overcome defects. And I had decided to stop smoking. And everybody else said, work the program on it. Say you're powerless over cigarettes, you want some God's help, go talk to somebody else, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, I'm a Marine. I'm going to freaking stop, and I'm not going to let myself. I'm going to say to myself, if you freaking die, you're not getting a cigarette. Screw you. Sit in. And I did. I just went, bam, you ain't having another cigarette. Don't even talk to me about a cigarette. And as soon as I'd go, I'm going to say, screw you, you're not getting one. And I made it. And I just went, look at that. I proved that you don't need help to make progress. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think that did to my pride? You think it took up about three notches? Do you think I improved spiritually by stopping smoking on my own? Or did I take 10 steps backwards by having a perspective, look what I can do by myself. Now I'll start working on other things. And I was deliberately putting together a case that I need God less than I used to. And so I remember that. I ran around and told everybody, you didn't see me at working the program on that. You just put your damn willpower. You just go there. You can do it. You can stop. Now, did that enhance my spiritual condition or deteriorate it? And I would submit what it did to my pride set me back a long ways. Okay, let me see if I had any other. Oh, there's one other conflict that comes in the middle of this. Knowing that we can't win this struggle, we have to constantly try to achieve perfection in this area. Bill, I think I mentioned this. I don't know if I mentioned it earlier or not. But there's one area where Bill's a little bit different in one place than another, and it's on this issue of perfection. He didn't want the four absolutes because he thought that alcoholics would go nuts trying to be perfect. You follow what I'm saying? Okay, just we need you to be absolutely honest, unselfish, loving, and pure. That one bothers me, so that's probably why I forget it. I don't know why they had to include that one as a character defect. And in a letter later on in life, Bill wrote that he disagreed with Akron and Cleveland that the four absolutes should be part of the program. And then he goes on to say, but I snuck them in the step 6 and 7 and the 12 and 12. And if you look there, he says, we need to raise our eyes towards perfection. Raise our eyes. Because the sixth step really is talking about perfection. We're entirely ready to get rid of all defects of character. All defects of character would be a perfect union with God. That's how they would be gone. And so he didn't want us to settle, as he writes in the 12 and 12, for as much perfection as would get us by. And it's human nature to go, after we've worked hard and achieved a certain level in AA, I think it's an exaggeration to say rest on our laurels, but it's easy to say to ourselves, I never thought I'd get this far. This is actually pretty damn good sobriety. I really have a pretty damn good life. I mean, this is really something. And Bill would go on to point out, the biggest enemy of the best is the good. That's the biggest enemy. We just say, see, when it's terrible, then we're willing to do something about it. When it gets up to good, to slightly better than good, or somewhere in this level, it's real easy to say, this is unbelievable. Look what this is good, but it's not the best. So the difference between the men and the boys is whether you want to push it up. And I think if by coming here, you're saying, I want to push it up. I don't want to stay where it's really pretty good. I used to think that would be good, but now I want to see what's above pretty good. I want to go and get closer. I want to find out how close I can get. And now we're going to be, tomorrow, shifting over to conscious contact and finding out what is being suggested, what are the stories about that. And I'll give you a hint. Oddly enough, the way to get out of storybook land, the way to shatter all these stories that we're trying to escape from, is oddly enough by telling stories. And we'll get into that tomorrow. Okay, we're at the end of the time. Thank you.